young friends.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
Be as gods, you know,
catapult of propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
One of the most interesting comments I've heard about Hollywood in recent days is a line from a blog post by our guest this week, and that is, there is hope in Hollyweird. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. I'm Derek Gilbert. Of course, we talk about Hollywood. We bring our friend who is an expert on things in Hollywood, especially how faith, fiction, and film intersect. He's the author of Chronicles of the Nephilim, the Chronicles of the Watchers series now in progress, the forthcoming Chronicles of the Apocalypse, and a number of nonfiction books that deal with storytelling from a Christian worldview. Brian Gadawa. Brian, it's good to talk to you again, brother.
Great to be here, Derek.
You attended a forum that was put on. Was this Variety Magazine that sponsored this this workshop?
Yes, yes. They've started this a couple years back. Once a year, for one day, they'll have a bunch of, basically a conference, a little mini conference, where they'll have a bunch of panel discussions. And the topic is faith and family in Hollywood, you know, productions, whether it's TV or movies or what have you. And this isn't just so much about the, you know, the Christian movie world. It includes some of that, you know, like the Facing the Giants type stuff. It's really more about the Hollywood studios, the real deal. Realizing that there is money to be made in the Christian market. So now all the studios actually have a Christian division in them. We could talk about that. There's still problems. And so some of the Christian movies are coming out now from, for instance, Sony Affirm. But by and large, this conference is more about, you know, not that the Christian subculture of Christian movies, you know, that we all know about, but really faith coming in real Hollywood movies, which has been exciting.
How have Christian films traditionally been represented in Hollywood? I mean, has there been, when I think of Christian films, I think of the, not since Charlton Heston was Moses, huh?
Yeah, you know, Passion of the Christ was the big turning point where, of course, you know, Mel spending his own money and, you know, making a gazillion dollars. And then Hollywood started saying, hey, wait a minute. There's some money to be made off these Christians. And of course, they don't understand the Christian demographic. So, you know, they started going into it and they couldn't understand it. They tried to put out a few films that just flopped because they don't understand the demographic. They're coming at it from as aliens. And half the time they're importing their own secular interpretation into a religious, you know, movie and not realizing why are these Christians offended and not seeing the movie, you know? So some of it is honestly just ignorance. They don't understand the market. And that's what, and of course I do believe that the Passion was a unique phenomenon. And I don't necessarily think it could be replicated because, you know, you've got the best film director in Hollywood, directing a movie about the, you know, the God of the Christians, you know, it's of all the religious issues, Jesus is the one who's most important to us. So when he makes a masterpiece of a movie, of course, that's going to resound throughout the world in a way that I don't think any other movie probably ever will, except maybe the sequel about the resurrection, which I heard Mel Gibson is also working on now. Randall Wallace. So, you know, but they did, they realized, Hollywood started realizing, you know, there's money to be made. But like I said, still, even after all these years, one of the things that I drew out of this conference was, well, two things. One is there are a lot more Christians who are involved in key decision-making positions, which is where they've never have been, and more content makers. So Christians are being involved more in the process. And this is really important because you can make all the movies you want, but if you don't have a distribution pipeline that gets it to the masses, it doesn't do any good. And that's where the key decision makers and the executives in Hollywood make a difference. And this, you know, Purpose Summit had a few of those there, describing what they're doing and how they're trying to grow and how they're trying to meet the demands of the market. There are others who were involved. There's a very diverse group of people. Not everyone agreed. There were plenty of people who argued that, yeah, they're trying to reach out and try to make movies for the Christian market, but they still don't get it because they don't understand the faith and how that works and what the, you know, what the demands are of the market or whatever. So there's this sort of, you know, mixture of people. Hollywood's not monolithic. And as much as I complain and gripe about it, Hollyweird and Babylon and such, which is true, there's a lot of evil. There's a lot of basically broken, miserable, bad people who like to stomp on other people. As much as that's true, there are also many within the industry, more increasing, you know, ongoing, this is where I'm encouraged, where they do want to bring good change and, meet the needs of a market that's not as interested in the nihilism and the darkness that so much of Hollywood can often capitulate to.
You mentioned an interesting phrase here, a distribution pipeline. Mike Norris, who is the director of a film we've talked about here on Skywatch TV, Amerigeddon, and you know, probably best known, and he kind of accepts it because he's nothing he can do about it anyway, Chuck Norris's son. Mike was talking about that very topic when he was here, about the difficulty in getting a truly Christian film distributed. What were some of the suggestions and ideas that came out of this summit for Christian films to get to the public?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because I wrote about on my blog at Godawa.com, I wrote about several things that stuck out to me. Like I said, it was very diverse. So that's the other thing. There's a lot of different opinions floating around, and I don't think it's got a strong base yet. But anyway, one of the things was authenticity. Now, this is a lot from the content makers, and that is those of us Christians who are Hollywood filmmakers. In other words, I'd say both Christians who are in Hollywood and those who are making Christian movies, authenticity is a key word. And what that means is both sides are really desirous to you know, bring spirituality and faith into stories, but in a way that's authentic, in a way that's real. What I mean is, you know, there is an awareness that we can't get away with making Christians all the good guys perfect lives and having it all together and atheists are all idiots, you know.
Right.
And there's an awareness that, you know, there's nothing wrong with showing the failures in a Christian's walk, including faith and doubt.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's not just that it's nothing wrong. It's a part and parcel of living as a human being.
Right.
So it's being true to the human experience, even as Christians. And I think we're seeing more and more of that. One of the latest examples is Miracles from Heaven. Here you have a Hollywood movie about a true story about a little girl who gets miraculously healed. And it's about the faith journey of her mother, which is played by Jennifer Garner. Mm. And that's out on DVD now. And, you know, actually, I watched this thing, man, and I'm telling you, I mean, it was made by Hollywood Studio, but it was a Christian movie with all the formula elements needed in there, including the scene where she goes into a church and talks alone to God, mm-hmm. which sometimes can be, you know,
cliche
and such.
Yeah.
But it was done well because it was done with quality and excellence in Hollywood and with an honesty that's needed. So authenticity is a key word. What else did I write? I forgot what the other thing was. And there's an awareness in the filmmakers and in the decision makers to I'm gonna have to find that. I forgot. Sorry about that.
That's all right.
I should have been more prepared for this, and I do apologize. But you know how it is when you get interviewed and you're all like, So
no worries. That's why we edit.
Okay, good. All right. So I'll start then again. Okay, gotcha. Okay. One of the other key takeaways that came out to me was that story is king. And one of the biggest problems with Christian movies, you know, that aren't coming out of Hollywood is they do tend to elevate their message over a good story.
Right.
And they'll sacrifice that. And it shows it becomes very preachy. And they sacrifice quality because the message is so important. Well, look, if you don't have a quality story, nobody's going to listen to you. So rather than saying story is everything and the message isn't anything, no, you just need to bring story up to the same level as of importance as your message. Mm-hmm. And that was coming out of Christian filmmakers as well as those in Hollywood. And then lastly, the thing that stood out to me was this label of faith-based. Almost everyone involved, including those who even made Christian movies or movies which were Hollywood and were positive towards faith, they hate the faith-based label. And the reason why is because it pigeonholes it. And so it makes the prejudices in people, in secular people, or people who might not be normally interested in that, but who might like enjoy the movie and learn something from it, it pigeonholes them and they stay away from watching the movie. And oftentimes, whether it's movies like Little Boy or Miracles from Heaven, it's really not about preaching a message at all. It does have a universal human connection. And so faith-based is one of those terms that can actually hurt a movie. In fact, I know for a fact that the movie Little Boy, which came out last year, great movie, World War II story, a little boy coming of age, his dad goes off to war. Mm. Fantastic little movie, and it was pigeonholed as faith-based, and it did terrible because of that, but it really wasn't a faith-based movie. It dealt with faith,
mm-hmm.
right? But it wasn't about that, and people stayed away from it because of their fears of that, oh, religion, preachy religion, right?
Yeah.
So there's a growing awareness in filmmakers as well that to stay away from that normal preachiness that so often haunts the Christian, you know, movie world.
But the thing is that it's kind of a weird dichotomy here that you've got producers that understand that there is a danger in getting a movie pigeonholed as faith-based, while at the same time trying to figure out how to reach out to a Christian audience, because there are people out there who will hold a movie night at church and look for films like this that they can show to a church group without having to worry about what they might be exposed to.
That is the other problem that I see in this big picture, and that is, there is, in essence, there is a sort of niche market of Christian moviegoers mm-hmm. that really do want the movies like God's Not Dead that are really right. blatant and aggressively Christian, because after all, look at how much money both movies made, right? Mm-hmm. So you can't criticize the existence of a genre because, I mean, horror films play the same formula over and over again, right?
Right.
Romantic comedies play the same formula over and over again. So the existence of a Christian movie formula is not bad in and of itself. But I do think that it can be limiting. But here's the problem. The problem is that there does seem to be a strong demarcation between the mainstream sort of movies that deal with spirituality and the Christian movies. So while, yes, you'll have, for instance, Miracles of Heaven, did very well because I'm not sure why, to be honest with you, because what I've seen is when movies try to play both sides of the fence, like it's both faith-based and a mainstream movie, it often doesn't do well. Hmm. But if it just goes for mainstream, doesn't push the spiritual side of things, it does well. Or if if it's a very Christian-y movie, it might do better in just the Christian market, only because word of mouth won't help it in the mainstream market. So basically it's finding that the difficulty for filmmakers is finding what niche they're going to fit into. And when you try to do both, it often actually doesn't work.
Hmm.
However, I'm going to qualify that. Because one of the exciting things that I saw come out of this conference was the awareness that, I already knew this, but I think this last year or two has been an amazing year for Hollywood mainstream movies becoming more positive towards the Christian faith. Mm. Now, look, it's not perfect, but it's much better. You've got The Miracles from Heaven. You had, before that, it was Heaven is for Real. You know, the theology in these movies wasn't the best, most orthodox of Christianity, but it was basically positive towards Jesus or positive towards Christian faith. And that's a good thing. And I've noticed that there's a lot more coming down the pike. For instance, two movies that I've already seen that are straight up Hollywood epics made by famous Hollywood people are very much faith stories. One of them is Ben-Hur.
Oh.
And I saw Ben-Hur. It's going to be coming out this month. It was produced by Roma Downey and Mark...
Edwards? No.
Mark Bennett.
Bennett.
Oh, I hope I got that right. Anyway, they're the ones that made the famous Bible TV series, right? Well, they did a remake of Ben-Hur, and they went back to the original novel. They stayed true to it. It's got it's the classic epic story with the giant chariot race at the end, this amazing battle scene in the middle where he's a slave on the galley ship. I was impressed by the action scenes, which I went in there not expecting much, but I was impressed that the level of quality was so high. Mm. And this is the story of revenge, forgiveness in the time of Jesus Christ. Ben-Hur has interactions with Christ at various times in his life, and the gospel is embodied within the story in forgiveness and atonement for sins and such in a very powerful, good Christian way. Now, there are always going to be the Christian fundamentalist types who will go and complain and say, you know, maybe they'll watch Ben-Hur and say, oh, it's a lovey-dovey Jesus without any gospel content, because they don't understand the power of story to embody the gospel in the actions, choices, and moral decisions of the characters. It's very strong within Ben-Hur. I highly recommend it. But my point is this is going to be, you know, one of the rare cases where it's going to have a mainstream audience and a faith-based audience. So it'll be interesting to see how well it does. Hmm. Like I said, I haven't seen that work that many times, so we'll see. The other exciting example that I heard about coming out of the conference, and then I just 2 days ago got to see a rough cut of the movie, is Hacksaw Ridge.
It's a new Mel Gibson film?
Mel Gibson film. Yeah, okay. It's Mel Gibson's return. Although it's interesting, most Hollywood types would have forgiven him long ago if he was a leftist.
Yes, yes.
But because he's right wing and conservative, they still don't forgive him. So they had to advertise on the trailer by the Academy Award winning director of Braveheart, and they didn't even put his name on it, right? So I'm just laughing. I'm going, don't worry, because the audience will forgive him. This is a powerfully redemptive film. It's a true story based on a Seventh-day Adventist Christian named Desmond Doss, who in World War II, he was a pacifist and he wouldn't carry a weapon, but he wanted to go help by being a medic. So his main tagline, or, you know, his slogan was, I want to save people, not hurt them, you know, not, I want to save lives, not take lives. Mm-hmm. Now, look, I have a lot of problems. We could talk about this with Seventh-day Adventism. I don't think it's a very good example of Christian faith. There's a lot of problems with the theology. And pacifism is completely and utterly unbiblical. Okay?
Right.
However, like Chariots of Fire, remember Chariots of Fire, you know, 1981, the classic, you know, hit. He wouldn't run on the Sabbath in the Olympic Games. Well, I think he was completely wrong. Mm-hmm. But the power of that story was he stood by his convictions of what he did believe as he sought to honor Christ. And that's what Hacksaw Ridge does. This guy refuses to do it. He gets persecuted by his fellow army men who are with him. But rightfully so, their worries are, well, you're not going to protect us, you know, so we can't trust you, right? He gets almost to the point of court-martial. Anyway, he ends up going there and going to Okinawa. And this infamous battle of Hacksaw Ridge that was a key turning point for them to taking the island. Thousands of men were killed through it. So Desmond doesn't carry a gun, but he goes up there and he saves. And I'm not giving anything away because this is all over the advertising. He saves 75 of his men when no one else was there.
Wow.
Everyone else retreated. He continued to stay and saved 75 of his men. It just sends shivers down my spine just talking about it now, because despite his bad Christian theology, his Christian acts of heroism and self-sacrifice is the most amazing story I've seen in decades. And of course, Mel Gibson is one of my favorite directors. He makes masterpieces, in my opinion, you know. And so I would highly recommend it. Oh, by the way, here's the other amazing thing I heard about this. This is where Gibson is more in tune with us, Christians and normal people in the world, than Hollywood is. He's having focus groups around the country and taking the reactions of Christians because he doesn't want to offend them. So they've already made alterations. Look, he's not going to compromise his artistic vision, but he wants to make us, doesn't want to offend us, you know? So he's doing his best to find a compromise. Already, they've taken out all the F-bombs that were in the movie in response to this. And they've taken out the Lord's name in vain, which was in there several times. Now, look, on my blog, again, go to my blog. I've written about, I haven't done an extensive review of it yet, but I've just given some hints about it. I think that that's not even biblical. I think it's fine to have cuss words. I think it's fine to have the Lord's name in vain, because it's in the Bible too. So, right? As long as you're showing it within the context of sinfulness, right?
Right.
However, the Christian demographic, I admit, doesn't like that stuff, right? Now, there's a lot of violence. It's gory because this is war. Mm-hmm. And Christians don't have as much a problem with violence. But nevertheless, you see what I'm saying is he's actually concerned. He's taken this stuff out. He even took out like a naked butt shot. There's now there's only one. It's part of humor, actually, of the movie. But you see, my point is he cares about what the audience, you know, he doesn't want to offend them. He wants to appeal to their spiritual sensibilities, even if he doesn't fully agree with that. And that's how I approach this movie, Hacksaw Ridge. I don't agree with the faith of the main character fully, but his actions show a Christian faith that make my Christian faith look like immature childishness. Mm-hmm. So quite frankly, you've got to see this film, people, when it comes out in November. I highly recommend it for anyone who's listening or watching.
You know, it's fascinating that there are films like this that, like you, as you say, really do a good job of synthesizing authenticity, real human action and responses to being placed in situations of stress with the issue of faith. And Mel Gibson is in another one of our films that I have to confess, I didn't watch it this way because I was watching it as a science fiction film. Sharon caught it right off the bat, and then I had to go back and watch it again. And I'm talking about M. Night Shyamalan's Signs, in which Gibson played the Anglican priest who'd lost his faith because his wife had been killed in what appeared to be just a senseless traffic accident. And as the story spins out, you begin to realize that all of these events have been put into play by God to save his children, to save their children. And when you finally realize, and it was only on the third viewing, I think, when I realized that as his dying wife was speaking to him, that it wasn't her speaking because she addressed, she was just repeating what she was hearing from wherever. And the parallels between Gibson's character and his son's character and the anger that his son feels about his mom having died and his dad not having done anything about it. That is one of the most Christian movies I have ever seen come out of Hollywood. And I'm almost surprised that it got made the way that it did, much less released, especially given Shyamalan's later films, the Happening or whatever, the one where all the trees rise up in rebellion.
Yeah.
Because we're hurting Mother Gaia. How did he get from the one to the other? But
no, it's very understandable, actually. He comes from a Hindu background. I'm not saying he's Hindu, but he's been influenced by Hinduism, which is very much of a polytheistic religion.
That's true.
So he has a positive spirituality to any faith. And that's why he was able to make a movie about the Christian faith. But because of his integrity and authenticity, he wanted to be true to that faith within its own paradigm. But you're right. I mean, ultimately, he also embraces Gaia.
Right.
And he also, you know, embraces other religious viewpoints as well. But nevertheless, because you have to give the guy credit and kudos for being true to that. And of course, I'm sure Mel Gibson had a lot of influence there, too. But you're right. Signs is a movie about the struggle between the providence of God and what we think is just chance in life. If there is no God, then all of life is chance and there's no meaning to anything, right?
Right.
That's a powerful message, you're right, to be made. But you know, there are a lot more movies that do wrestle with these kind of issues and are coming out from the mainstream. For instance, just recently, within the last couple years, you know, now one of my favorites is horror. And horror films are not for everyone. But particularly when you're dealing with the demonic realm, which is a spiritual reality that, let's face it, modern man does reject spirituality, right? Oh, demons and angels are just fantasy, right? Fairy tale, right? But you've got these horror films like The Conjuring and The Conjuring 2, which come out and deal with the reality of demon possession. And how I remember the first movie, at least, The Conjuring, the name of Jesus was used in that movie as the means of overcoming the demon, which you don't see in Hollywood movies.
No, you don't.
Normally it's just God in general, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that was written by a couple of Christians. Then, of course, there was the movie that came out, Deliver Us from Evil, another thriller directed by Scott Derrickson and written by him. True story based on a cop tracking down a murderer who's demon-possessed. And it's all about how the cop who doesn't have faith has lost his faith as well. And he has to confront the fact that he has sin in his life that's unconfessed, right? Because he's no longer faithful. Mm-hmm. And he can't overcome that spiritual evil until he really has a repentance and confession of sin in his own life. Mm-hmm. See, this is powerful Christian messages, themes in Hollywood movies. So they are getting made. Yes, I want to see more. But the good news is they are getting made, and there are more coming down the pike. And whether or not it's just a matter of pandering to an audience to make money, as long as they stay true to what, to the Christian demographic, you know, what we want, that's, I don't have anything to complain about that.
Yeah. How is our new technologies, new delivery channels, like going straight to, say, a Vimeo Pro using other or YouTube Red or whatever, using those avenues to reach audiences, is that something that might change the traditional paradigm of movie distribution?
I think so, and it's definitely going that direction. It's not fully there yet. Right now, it's best for independent filmmakers who couldn't get a shot anywhere. So, hey, you know, getting it on YouTube or Vimeo actually can help. But I do think that it's not quite there yet. And it's growing. It's growing. But there was something else that came to my mind. You were talking about the distribution pipelines. There is an element of marketing that has changed, and it is touching upon even mainstream movies. Now, obviously, you still have big bucks. Whoops. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Obviously, you still have big bucks advertising that goes on with the big blockbuster movies, right? You see TV ads, billboards, or whatever. Mm-hmm. But a lot of that money has changed and is now being turned into social media marketing.
Right.
Because even the big places have found that the word of mouth, having a fewer amount of devoted fans engaging in word of mouth, is far better than the big advertising pushes. This is where the Christian movies have excelled, I think, because they've operated differently. For example, and it started with The Passion. The Passion, he did an end run around Hollywood advertising, and he went straight to grassroots marketing. And that's part of the reason why it did so well. And now that's what he's doing again with his new movie. Ah. And the Christian movies like God's Not Dead and the Sherwood Baptist movies, Courageous and all that, they utilize that Christian church market to really get the word out. So it's social media, word of mouth marketing that is a lot more powerful for niche markets in particular, like the Christian market. And that's what you really have to do if you want to sell well right now for the Christian market. Hmm. But I think what I see is mainstream movies are also pouring heavily into social media because it's much more, they can see the results much more powerfully than in the national advertising campaigns.
Yeah. Well, I think it's because, you know, even among Christians and especially Christian teens, you got more people paying attention to this than paying attention to what's on television or in newspaper advertising anymore. There was a movie that you mentioned, and maybe this is a little early to jump to this, but it's the next thing that comes to mind. And not a Christian movie per se, but another one that you saw recently. And we've had a couple of people here at Skywatch TV watch it and rave about it. And this is the Dinesh D'Souza film, Hillary's America. What are your thoughts about that film?
Yeah, I saw that as well. I think it was a really good docuganda, and I highly recommend it.
Docuganda.
Now, when I say docuganda, what that means is it's sort of like a hybrid. It's a documentary, but it is propaganda. Now, propaganda is not inherently bad or evil. Propaganda simply means you're promoting a singular viewpoint, and you're stressing that viewpoint and not sort of addressing as much the other side. Mm-hmm. And that's not entirely true either, because Hillary's America does address the other side of the coin. But all that I'm saying is Michael Moore has changed the face of documentary feature film documentaries forever. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're going to make a feature film, it has to be about you, the guy. It's a more personal, idiosyncratic approach. Now, there are documentaries that go straight to Netflix or PBS or whatever. But even those documentaries, you know, you've got to be not just honest, but have some education and maturity to recognize that documentaries are not objective. They're always very much, you know, spinning to the viewpoint of the filmmakers. And you've got to be careful not to be manipulated by them. Because I think the illusion that they're being objective is the biggest lie of all.
Right.
So
right.
I've watched lots of documentaries on Netflix, for instance, and they're all, you know, they're giving their left-wing viewpoint and trying to make it look like it's objective,
right.
But it just isn't. Well, the good thing about just being open and honest and making a movie, a docuganda movie, where there's an integrity and authenticity to it, right?
Yeah.
So it's the story. Basically, it's Dinesh D'Souza describing his own journey in looking into the background of the Democratic Party. And what I liked about it as a film was, it was, you know, one of the things about documentaries, you know, they'll do the picture, like, especially if they're going to do something historical about the history of the Democratic Party. I think it had these film clips and pictures where they're zooming in and out. You know, it's kind of boring. So what he does is he does a lot of dramatizations. Now, there's always some dramatizations in documentaries nowadays, but his, almost half of it was.
Hmm.
And I found it not just more entertaining, but it made the story come to life more. For instance, he's talking about how, you know, one of his main points is that, you know, the common misunderstanding is that the Republican Party is the racist party. They're racists and homophobes and all this kind of stuff. And he goes, well, actually, it's the Democratic Party that is racist. And their history is one of racism. They were the ones that supported slavery.
Right.
The Republican Party actually was started to fight slavery.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
But the Democrats weren't just that. They were also the party of the KKK.
Right.
They were the party of the Jim Crow laws. They are the party of the modern day form of slavery, which is the urban plantations and modern welfare.
Right.
So in reality, he went into some of their characters and like, you know, Andrew Jackson and some of these guys in the past. And he did little dramatizations that helped you to see, you know, you can show pictures of the KKK black and white, you know, but if you show them on their horses running through with torches, getting ready to lynch a guy, that's really powerful imagery. So it really brought home the message in a dramatic way that was really good. Now, the first half of the movie covers the background of the Democratic Party. The second goes into Hillary Clinton and how, you know, she's obviously a part of that party. And in some ways, you know, it's almost like you're watching two films, you know, because he doesn't connect it as well as he could have. But the second part, he talks about the history of Hillary Clinton and how she's rooted in radical leftism and Saul Alinsky.
Mm-hmm.
And if you understand, Americans are so woefully uneducated. If you really understand the political philosophy that they're operating under, whether it's Barack Obama or actually the whole left, the whole Democratic Party, you really would be terrified. And so he tries to bring home that unknown history behind them to help you make a more informed choice, you know, at the voting booth, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's plenty of mockeries about Donald Trump and, you know, the mainstream media is just making those all the time.
Right.
This is probably the only feature documentary or documentary that actually deals with Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party. And he's done what nobody has done before in terms of unveiling this stuff. It's truly fascinating. And I might add, I believe it's probably at least the second or third highest grossing documentary. It's the highest documentary grosser of the year, but I think it's on its way to be the third of all time.
Wow.
Of course, the number one is Fahrenheit 9/11,
right.
That abominable atrocity of lies.
Michael Moore, yeah.
By Michael Moore. But then the second one was 2016 Obama's America, which was also done by Dinesh D'Souza.
Right, right.
And that, in my mind, was the best, most fearful description. Fearful, most fair,
truthy,
yeah. I thought it was the most accurate understanding of who Obama really was. And, you know, rather than painting him as this, you know, conspiratorial guy who's trying to destroy America. It's like, if you understand he comes from an anti-colonialist mindset,
right,
then you understand why he's trying to de-arm America and make us weaker, not because he wants us to destroy us, although that will happen. It's because he really believes we're the bullies. And so we need to let other people become more powerful. And that will keep everyone balanced and equal, which, of course, that leads to tyranny, one world globalism and,
right,
and the destruction of America. But nevertheless, it is a more truthful depiction of where his ideology really comes from. So Dinesh D'Souza has become quite an important filmmaker in my mind in this current decade, because he's the one who's boldly, courageously going where nobody else is.
Hmm. And he paid a price for it, too, with prosecution for accidentally, apparently giving too much money in a political campaign.
Look, it wasn't accidental, and he does admit it. And in fact, he dramatizes that in the film.
Yes.
Shows how he went to jail and how he had to serve. But it's interesting, and he admits that he was wrong. But if you look at the facts of the case, it was interesting. He's the only one that was prosecuted by the IRS, whereas
right, right,
dozens of Democrats have been doing the same thing he does. But the IRS, obviously in the pocket of Obama, went after him after he made that movie about
right,
Obama.
Exactly.
So they clearly did it for that reason. And that doesn't justify, or that doesn't let him off the
right,
hook. But it does show you that there's a greater evil than what he did. But what he says is, and he shows this, he's you know, with all these crooks and criminals, and he says, hey, I've got time, so I might as well get to know them. Starts talking to them, and he finds out the psychology of criminals and how they operate, how they plan, strategize, how they pull it off, and then how they deny. Perpetual denying is how they continue in their life of crime to be successful. And he shows how he suddenly realized that was the same psychology of Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
So it's a psychology of crime. And so it was really, again, funny, humorous, but also very insightful.
Yeah, those are the comments from Lynn, one of our wonderful women who work in the office back here and try to keep up with Tom Horn's crazy deals. You know, the running joke here at Skywatch TV is, you know, buy a book and get an RV. But Lynn and her husband Stan went to see it, and that's exactly what she said. It was brilliantly done. And the scene where he's teaching English as a second language to a group of prisoners there, and you know, teaches them that they'll finally realize that they are Americans when they become Republicans. Was really funny.
Yeah, a little over the top, but,
yeah,
but you know what? Again, a touch of humor and a touch of hyperbole. Hey, what about the Comedy Central? What about Jon Stewart? What about Stephen Colbert?
Talk
about hyperbole and exaggeration.
Exactly,
right? They can do it.
John Oliver.
Look.
Yep.
Yeah, there's all these double standards when it comes to judging conservatives and their media. So if you pull back and realize, hey, you know, it's partly humorous, partly truthful. It's a wonderful, great movie to go see.
Yeah. One of the things that I really appreciate about your work and your fiction work is the way that you have demonstrated that anybody who wants to write fiction can't do better than draw on the palette that the Bible gives us, that you've got everything in there for epic storytelling, you know, gods and devils and demons and wizards and magicians and monsters and epic battles that that are fought not just in the physical realm, but also in the supernatural realm. You've got a book forthcoming in the fall. And I guess we can go ahead and get people ready for this now. Let them know that it's on the way, called The Imagination of God. Is that title? Explain the thought behind that title.
Sure. Thanks for bringing it up. Actually, September 1, it should be on sale, audio, Kindle, and paperback at Amazon. I may even try to put it for pre-order. That's a good idea. I should probably do that. I'll do that today.
So, 7%, and
yeah,
you can have the idea.
Okay, so people go to Amazon and do a pre-order. Anyway, The Imagination of God is the basis of it was this. As a Christian, I was brought up with a very conservative approach to my theology and understanding, which I still have. My heritage is Reformed. It's traditional, conservative, evangelical, all that kind of stuff. But I've also been an artist. And I've tended to live my life in almost like with a dichotomy. I have this very wild love of imagination in the arts, but then my theology is very conservative. And I found it hard to integrate the two, you know, because on the one hand, one is more restrained and the other seems to be more let loose. And of course, while I appreciated the art separately, to approach my faith with imagination, creativity, always scared me, because the image, drama, poetry, these things are not clear. They're ambiguous, whereas theology is clear and distinct ideas, mm-hmm. right? It's sharp. Well, these are the misunderstandings that I labored under for many years, because I kind of had to get to the point where I realized, as I studied the Bible more, oh no, God himself communicates theology actually in the Bible. If you really want to be technical, if you want to be rational, about 20% of the Bible is propositional truth, right? In other words, these are theological truths about God or something like that. These are statements that are true about God or whatever. Mm-hmm. But about 80% of it is story, symbol, narrative, poetry, imagery, and fantasy stuff, you know, mm-hmm. like visions and dreams, right? So I had to relearn sort of how to take imagination and integrate it into my faith without becoming a liberal or falling away and, you know, that kind of a thing, thinking mm-hmm. the Bible's just a bunch of myths. No, you don't have to conclude that. You just have to learn how those two are balanced. So I ended up writing in the imagination of God to make that connection with other Christians who are having that hard time of appreciating how the imagination, how art, how creativity in the Bible can actually be a part of your faith journey in a way. Now, by the way, now listen to me when I say this. I'm actually showing you that it's an essential part of understanding God. In other words, beauty, that is aesthetics, mm-hmm. that is the arts, get it? It's all part of the same thing. Beauty, understanding God, you must understand beauty or you don't understand him fully. You can understand his rational side, you can understand the propositions, and that's good, but it's not enough. And the extent to which you don't understand the poetic side of God and the beauty of his holiness, right? Not just the rationality. To that extent, you are not fully grasping God as deep as he can be grasped. So I'm not just saying art should be acceptable, we should appreciate it. I'm saying it's an essential key part of our spirituality. Hmm. And that's my controversial challenge, right? So I try to expose all the art and creativity that's in the Bible in a way to help people see how God utilizes it so that we don't have to be so afraid of it.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I'm thinking now of some essays that I've read by a science fiction writer whose work I've really come to appreciate over the last year or so. John C. Wright was an interview guest on this program about a year ago. He's written some really mind-bending stuff. Now, he comes at it from a very conservative Roman Catholic perspective, but even, you know, what you take that into account, and he's still showing the struggle between good and evil. But he writes a lot of essays at his blog, and one of the things that a theme that he returns to is how in our postmodern world, when God is removed from the equation, what is passing for art these days is really ugliness. It is nihilistic. It glorifies death and mediocrity instead of the beauty that you're describing and art as an essential component of understanding God. In fact, you kind of allude to that in your blog post about the Variety Faith Summit when discussing the level of technical quality, the production values of Christian films.
Yes.
You know, talk a little bit about that. What is the relationship between trying to make a good film and trying to serve God?
Excellent question. And that gets to the heart of everything. In my book, I basically draw up a binary opposition of two things that are going on in the Christian church. And that's between word and image, right? So word represents words, books, mm-hmm. reading, good stuff. Image represents visual, poetry, art, and creativity, right? So you've got word versus image. And you've got more traditional churches tend to be word-oriented, right? And so therefore, you know, they'll have that, you know, they'll have an emphasis on order and not getting out of control, having everything in its place. And then more postmodern approach, or Catholic, because, you know, the Catholic does have a better appreciation of the image. Mm-hmm. They'll be more image-oriented, which is be more open, more creative, that kind of a thing. But my argument in the book is both sides are imbalanced without the other. What we need is an equal ultimacy of both word and image. And the traditional stresses the word to the without the image, and the postmodern or the modern or the contemporary Christian church stresses the image to the, you know, they don't value theology as much because that's just a bunch of rational ranting and raving, right? But to the extent that we devalue either is the extent to which we get imbalanced. So my goal is to try to bring image back up to an equal ultimacy. And what do I found this in? I found it in the incarnation of Jesus Christ himself, right? The gospel of John, word became flesh.
Oh, yeah.
Word became image. See?
Yes.
And in Christ, his humanity and his deity, neither, to the extent that you devalue one of those, you become a heresy. See? So I'm making the same argument that we have devalued image for too long. And you know, again, from the more traditional conservative sort of branches. Mm-hmm. And I talk a little bit about how the Catholic Church did understand image, but they went off to the extreme. And then the Protestant Reformation reacted against that and brought the pendulum to the other side.
Right.
So we're still struggling with the fruit of that. But I do think that the modern church, the contemporary church, is more in tune with the image. They just have the danger of rejecting theology as a needless waste of arrogance, right? Because we can't know the truth in this kind of stuff, you know, postmodern stuff. Mm-hmm. And to that extent, they're going to cause just as much damage.
Mm. That's a good place to wrap it up, because I think that is a excellent summation of your thesis, counselor, and we now put it to the jury for their decision. Brian Gadawa, the author of the forthcoming book, The Imagination of God, and of course, a number of books that we talked about here on A View from the Bunker. His website is gadawa.com, and of course, I'll put a link to that and a link to the blog posts that we've discussed in the show notes. What else you got in the pipeline that you can tell us about?
Well, I am working on a Bible movie for a Hollywood producer.
I wondered if you'd be able to share about that.
No, I still can't talk about it yet, because actually there are problems with the company, because, you know, Hollywood is always changing and companies get sold and bought out, and we're kind of in the middle of some turmoil. Anything can happen. It could move forward. It may not. So at the point in time where things are going a little bit more forward, I'll definitely contact. We'll have a whole show on it. But
awesome.
Thanks for asking.
Awesome. Brian Gadawa, good to talk to you again, brother, and look forward to doing it again soon.
Likewise, my friend.
As always, I'll put a link in the show notes to Brian's website. It's pretty simple, gadawa.com. He's got a lot of great information there. Highly recommend his books, both fiction and nonfiction. He is a great resource, bridging the world of serious theology and the use of story, of myth, if you will, in order to convey serious theological points. So again, gadawa.com for Brian's latest. Coming up, well, before I get to that, there's a story this week that Sharon and I talked about on Sci Friday this week. And if you've not been following us on Sci Friday, hope you do. We've got a Facebook page for Sci Friday. We've also got it's set aside its own YouTube channel for Sci Friday. So I encourage you to go to youtube.com/SciFriday and subscribe, because, well, we got to stay ahead of Josh Peck's Into the Multiverse, and, you know, because he's got additional verses from which he can draw viewers, that's a real tough challenge. This week we talked about the use of technology to try to summon contact, the spirit realm, and more than that, to weaponize the occult, which is a topic of research that the U.S. government, the Russian government, other governments, presumably UK for sure, have been involved in, especially since the end of World War II. We got onto that topic because of the story from Moscow of the woman who went to bed playing Pokemon Go and then told police later that she awoke to find a giant Pokemon in the bed with her and her husband attempting to sexually assault her. Now, on the surface, you can imagine the reaction of her husband, the police, even the psychic that she attempted to get some relief from. The woman is now undergoing psychiatric counseling. But the question is she really crazy? We've talked over the past couple of years of a couple of stories, actually several cases of murder and attempted murder by teens who thought they were pleasing entities that were created as crowdsourced horror characters, creepypastas, Laughing Jack, Slenderman, others, Jeff the Killer. And the question is, are demonic entities manifesting in these forms that these people have been fixated on? Or somehow is the spiritual energy of thousands, perhaps millions of creepypasta readers and Pokemon Go players actually giving form to these entities? Now, personally, I think it's a demonic manifestation. But the other aspect of the story from Moscow that was intriguing is that a growing number of Pokemon Go players in Japan, the UK, and elsewhere around the world are convinced that their pets can see these Pokemon. In other words, while they're playing the game and viewing the world through an augmented reality filter, the Pokemon Go game, their pets are apparently able to see and respond to the Pokemon that they can see on the screen but can't see with their natural eyes. Now, again, just coincidence that their pets are reacting to something that apparently is occupying the same space as whatever's in the game? Yeah, maybe. Maybe. But remember that the United States government and, again, government agencies from governments around the world over the past 70 years have been trying to find ways to scientifically systematize and control our interactions with the spirit realm for the purpose of weaponizing the supernatural. Have we opened doors that we wish now we could close? It's worth thinking about. We'll probably be talking about that more on this program and on Skywatch TV in the months ahead. Coming up on this program, more interviews from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference in July. Ken Johnson and Doc Marquis are next up on the list. That'll come up on August 17th. Next Sunday, John Haller, who has an excellent weekly prophecy teaching from his Fellowship Bible Chapel in Columbus, Ohio. Worth subscribing to that YouTube channel for his weekly look at the news and how that fits into a prophetic paradigm. We talked this time about how maybe we should be a little more gracious to people who disagree with our particular interpretation of prophecy, because we're probably not going to get it all correct until after the fact, until after Jesus returns, he can actually sit us down and explain it to us, you know, face to face. That program, God willing, coming August 21st. On the 24th, Tom Hughes and Joel Richardson from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. And then on 28th of August, Aaron Judkins. He is trying to raise support in order to participate in an archaeological dig at the Qumran Plateau or near the Qumran Plateau in Israel. This dig is headed up by Dr. Randall Price, and Aaron is looking for some support, and we will do what we can to help direct some attention his way, because this is a an important dig. They believe they found a new cave that could contain more scrolls, as yet undiscovered, from the cache hidden by whoever it was who hid the scrolls at Qumran. August 31st, Paul McGuire and Dr. Michael Lake from the Rocky Mountain International Prophecy Conference. Then on September 4th, wanted to work a little further ahead in the schedule so I could tell you about this particular interview and the one that follows it on the 11th of September. Kay Rubicek will be our guest. She's a first-time guest on A View from the Bunker. She's the producer of a new documentary film called Hard to Believe. Hard to Believe documents the practice by the government of China of using prisoners of conscience as raw material for live organ harvesting. They may be harvesting from as many as 100,000 prisoners per year, which, just running some rough numbers, could be into the tens of billions of dollars in revenue as they supply organs for a growing demand worldwide. As the population ages, the clientele for these organs is not all Chinese. Organ tourist is becoming a thing. If there wasn't a market for these organs, the political prisoners in China wouldn't be sliced up to serve that need. So we talk with the producer of the film, Hard to Believe, Kay Rubicek, on September 4th. And then on the 11th of September, Ken Stone, the director of the film. This is hideous. and we need to be aware of it. We need to start putting pressure on our elected officials here in the United States, the UK, and elsewhere to pressure the government of China to stop it and perhaps enact laws that would make it illegal to travel to China for the purpose of obtaining a transplant organ. And this is something that I know hits close to home for a lot of people. I personally know family members who have died because they couldn't get a heart or kidneys quickly enough. They were of an age where available organs were prioritized to younger recipients. That is a shame, but it does not justify the execution of people deemed undesirable by the state for the purpose of profiting from this demand for human organs. So September 4th, September 11th, a pair of interviews that I hope you'll make time to listen to. Our weekly Bible study, moving from the darkness to the light, the gospel of Jesus Christ. Sharon and I spend a week each on the Old Testament and the New Testament, going through each of the Testaments in chronological order. We post those studies by midday Sunday at gilberthouse.org. That's gilberthouse.org, and I hope you'll join us for those. Skywatch TV this coming week, we'd start something new as we talk music with Joe Horn. And it's about the new CD released by Joe and his band. Many of the members are members of his family. So you get to see Joe, his two sisters, their mom, and a couple of family friends in, one family friend and one in-law, let's put it that way. It's Joe Horn and Broken for Good. The disc is called Right Where You Stand, and that's the topic for the next 3 weeks on Skywatch TV. For dates and times, log on to skywatchtv.com and then look in the top menu bar where it says channels. We thank you for your reviews on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever else you download A View from the Bunker. And please remember, we're now available on YouTube as well. I ask you to subscribe to my YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/Derek Gilbert. A View from the Bunker is a production of Gilbert House and released under a Creative Commons Attribution No Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod. His website is incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.